The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
On Tuesday, January 1st, 1985, police removed a sign nailed to a tree on the 8200 block of Westgate Boulevard in Southwest Austin. The sign, fashioned out of a piece of plywood and orange and white paint, was purposely placed near where a checkbook was found. The checkbook of a woman found sexually assaulted and slain the previous month. Even considering the sign's message, which was a direct warning to women in the area, as well as a sort of call to action, police were suspicious of its creator, and they removed it to process for fingerprints. The homemade placard included the biological sign for male with an X through it, and read, "Women Beware, Lauren McCarty, raped here, December 17, 1984. I'm ready for blood. Are you?" Another presumed crime against a young woman had happened just a week before Lauren's disappearance, sexual assault, and murder, and the similarities were both odd and striking. There was one major difference between Lauren McCarty's murder and the circumstances of the other case, though. Sarah McCauley was never seen or heard from again, neither alive nor dead, after she vanished. Born to Adam and Violet Zelensky in New Jersey, Sharon Sarah Zelensky was the only daughter of the couple. The Zelensky family eventually settled in El Paso in the 1970s, where Sharon attended Eastwood High School. Sharon was creative and artistic. In 1974, she won a prestigious art award while attending Eastwood. In 1977, the year her mother died of pancreatic cancer in El Paso, Sharon was living in Austin, a city that was most likely a better fit for her bohemian personality. Her photo can be seen in the Austin Statesman newspaper in 1981, selling fresh floral bouquets on Valentine's Day to love-struck passers-by in the cold weather, her artistic side apparent in her hippie-ish style. At some point along the way, for reasons unknown, Sharon began going by the name Sarah, and by 1983, she'd be known by a new last name, too. At the Austin State Hospital, in the summer of 1980, where she worked as a licensed vocational nurse, Sarah began a friendship with a man named John McCauley. The two were drawn to one another by a mutual interest in the outdoors, camping together often at Pedernales Falls State Park, about 40 miles west of Austin and 10 miles east of Johnson City. On Saturday, May 7, 1983, at sunrise, Sarah and John McCauley were married atop Mount Bonnell in Austin alongside the Colorado River. Exchanging vows with a panoramic view of the city, the surrounding hill country, and the winding river. By this time, Sarah had grown physically and emotionally tired of her work at the state hospital and had been working for the Internal Revenue Service. John, who also wasn't happy at the hospital, began working at L&M Volksworks, a Volkswagen-specific mechanics and customization shop in far north Austin. Sarah and John lived in Austin's Hyde Park District, an area that was one of the city's first suburban developments. Their apartment in the historical Adams House was small and located just north of the University of Texas campus on Avenue G. The couple, too, had bought a piece of property in North Austin where they intended to build a house, one with a large garage so John could repair and build cars there. Sarah was planning to attend Austin Community College in the spring 1985 semester to get a biology degree and then move on to a pre-med program. She sought to eventually open a practice in Austin, but it was just as important to her, if not more so, to be able to travel to countries where medical aid was scarce or non-existent so that she might offer her services. John later said of his wife that she appreciated what she had and she wanted to give back. He also said of Sarah, "She was a very spiritual person. She believed in reincarnation. She wasn't afraid of death. She was aware of a better place beyond the physical plane." At lunchtime on Monday, December 10th, 1984, Sarah picked up her husband John from L&M Volksworks, located at 2105 Howard Lane, approximately 12 miles from the couple's apartment. They traveled about 7 miles south to eat lunch at a restaurant on the 9500 block of North Lamar Boulevard. The couple had a normal, uneventful meal together. "There was nothing out of the ordinary," John later said. After lunch, Sarah dropped John back off at work somewhere around 1:40 p.m. She drove off from L&M Volksworks heading east on Howard Lane toward Interstate 35. Sarah mentioned to John at lunch that she needed to buy a Christmas tree stand and that she'd return to the apartment shortly thereafter. John presumed that she'd do a little holiday shopping and return home long before he got off work and made it to the apartment. But when he did, almost 5 hours later, at 6:30 p.m., Sarah wasn't there. He was immediately worried.
"It's completely out of character not to call if she's going to be late or going somewhere," John McCauley said of his wife.
He and Sarah, like so many other couples, had an unwritten but strictly followed rule. If one was going to be late or had a change in plans, the other was to be notified. It's difficult to imagine to most that a loved one has become the victim of a crime when virtually every aspect of life is normal and comfortable. John waited around some to hear from Sarah, thinking that maybe she simply forgot to call, or in a time before cell phones, perhaps she called after he left work and just missed him. Still, there was no note, and when the worry became too much, John began phoning family and friends to see if anyone had heard from her. None of them had, and John waited up all night for Sarah to return. He'd later remark that the memory of that night remains vivid in his mind. He remembered the bitter cold and the trees as he waited for her to show up and her distinct 1965 Volkswagen Beetle. Most of all, though, he recalled the fear he felt. After waiting up all night for his wife Sarah to return home, John McCauley found out that she also hadn't made it to work at the Austin IRS Center. John called the Austin Police Department and reported Sarah and her vehicle missing immediately after finding out. He told them he'd last seen her the day before, Monday, December 10th, 1984, when they ate lunch together, and he feared for her safety. The police issued a BOLO, a Be on the Lookout, for Sarah's 1965 Volkswagen Beetle, and though the car was relatively common at the time, hers was easily discernible from most. It was off-white, with a faded orange hood, and the front bumper was missing. 25-year-old Sarah was last seen wearing dark blue slacks with white pinstripes, a dark purple shirt with sleeves that reach the elbow, and white tennis shoes with red stripes on the side. She has long black-brown hair and brown eyes, wears contact lenses, and has a tattoo of a red and yellow butterfly on her abdomen. As patrol officers kept watch for such a vehicle and driver, John McCauley remained at the couple's apartment, waiting for word that they'd found something. Torturous hypothetical scenarios played out in his head, and everywhere he looked, he was reminded of Sarah, as if her spirit permeated the small dwelling, and in a way it did.
She liked to sew and knit, John said, continuing, she liked to do things with her hands that were artsy. This apartment is full of her. Her being gone is like a bad dream. I wake up and I look around and realize it's really happening.
The pink and purple Afghan blanket draping over the sofa and ornaments on the Christmas tree that his wife had crocheted and crafted, respectively, were reminders that she was gone, as was the quilt Sarah made that laid in her and John's bedroom. The day after law enforcement was notified that Sarah was missing, on Wednesday, December 12, 1984, a resident of the Lanier Plaza Apartments read an article in the Austin Statesman regarding Sarah's disappearance. It immediately clicked in the reader's head that they noticed a vehicle matching the description of Sarah's 1965 Volkswagen in their apartment's parking lot. They called the police, who then discovered the missing woman's car there. The apartment complex where the Volkswagen Beetle was found was about 5.5 miles from John's place of employment, the last place Sarah was known to have been seen.
I don't know why she would go there, Sarah's best friend, Allison, would later remark, explaining, as far as I know, she doesn't know anyone over there.
Allison also said that Sarah probably didn't have car trouble because John had just tuned up the car. Austin police questioned several individuals at the apartment complex. Many folks said they remembered seeing someone who fit Sarah McCauley's description entering an apartment there. One individual was specific, telling officers that they saw such a woman entering an apartment on the second floor. Nothing, though, was gleaned from the possible witnesses at the Lanier Plaza Apartments. Law enforcement could not ascertain why Sarah's Volkswagen was there, not to mention who put it there. There were no signs of foul play. Austin Police Lieutenant Charles Franklin remarked that there was no blood found in or around the unlocked car. Sarah's keys and her purse, thought to contain around $170 in cash, weren't in the vehicle, and police later confirmed what Sarah's best friend had said. The car was operable and had not broken down. The following Friday, December the 14th, Sarah's husband, John McCauley, submitted to a polygraph examination. Few leads had come investigators' way since he reported his wife missing, and, as is standard practice in most investigations of this type, police sought to rule out, or rule in, those closest to the missing person or victim.
That was hard, John said of the test, adding, they asked me the first set of questions that were all pretty basic. Then they asked me just about the same questions later, but threw in things like, have you talked to Sarah since she's been gone? Was Sarah hurting when you last saw her?
The polygraph showed that John did not use deception, that he truly didn't know where his wife was or what happened to her. Austin detectives got a tip not long after. In southwest Austin, near the shopping mall Barton Creek Square on Bee Cave Road, two possible witnesses told authorities, Sarah's Volkswagen Beetle was seen parked alongside the road at about 5 p.m. on the day she went missing. Bee Cave Road, also known as Ranch to Market Road 2244, runs alongside many areas that are densely forested, much more so in 1984 than today. The tip led Sarah's husband, John, to concentrate his search efforts in that area. John, who was unable to return to work with his wife missing, gathered a group of friends to search there the following Sunday. About 3 miles west of Loop 360, they combed through the rough and unforgiving thickets and hills and along Bee Cave Road. He told reporters that both the worst and best case scenarios have gone through his mind. He was trying to keep his hopes up, John said, but facing the reality that Sarah had been gone so long had left him fear-stricken and made it difficult to get up in the mornings.
I've got a lot of friends, he said. They're keeping me going.
Having no choice, John McCauley returned to work a week after Sarah vanished. His searches now limited to nights and weekends, his friends continuing to be at his side. Commenting again that they had no evidence of foul play, Austin police said that though fingerprints had been found on Sarah's vehicle, there was nothing else to suggest that anyone was involved in her disappearance.
I can tell you right now that we have absolutely nothing to go on,
Austin Homicide Sergeant John Cochran told news reporters.
We don't know if she left on her own or was kidnapped and killed.
If people were not paying attention to the disappearance of Sarah McCauley, they were a week later when 21-year-old Lauren Marie McCarty went missing. The disappearance of a second young woman, in fact, set off alarm bells for all local women. On her lunch break from her secretarial job at the Texas Municipal Courts Training Center on San Antonio Street in downtown Austin, Lauren McCarty had an errand to run before grabbing a bite to eat. It was Monday, December 17, 1984. She left the building wearing a lavender t-shirt and blue jeans and hopped in her beige 1980 Plymouth Horizon. Lauren headed to the main post office, about a half mile away on 9th Street, to send a package. The young woman, however, never returned from her lunch break, and a worried coworker called police to report her missing. Neither friends nor family had heard from Lauren. Police, like in Sarah McCauley's disappearance, commented that they had no reason to suspect foul play. Unlike in Sarah's case, however, they'd soon discover otherwise. The following day, the 18th, on the 8200 block of Westgate Boulevard, over 8 miles away from where she'd last been seen, Lauren's checkbook was found. On Saturday, the 22nd, at about 9 a.m., a patrol officer spotted Lauren McCarty's vehicle in South Austin in a parking lot behind the Westgate Mall, about 6 miles from where she was last seen and 4 miles from where her checkbook was found. Officers looked around in the car, but nothing could prepare them for what they discovered as they opened the Plymouth's trunk. Inside was the bloodied, maliciously beaten body of Lauren McCarty. Upon her autopsy, the medical examiner determined that she died as the result of blunt force trauma to the head. The weapon, an object like a rock or pipe, he said. She was struck 5 times to the back of her head, 9 times to the right side. After she'd already succumbed to the beating, Lauren had been stabbed in the chest and neck 3 times. The terrible and brutal beating was worsened by the determination by the medical examiner that she'd been raped and by the fact that she'd been restrained during the homicidal attack. Her hands were tied in front of her with a heavy white twine. The totality of the murder notwithstanding, it was the heavy white twine used to bind Lauren that caught the attention of John McCauley. The first thing that John thought of when he heard that particular detail was the white rope he'd used to tie down the hood of his missing wife's Volkswagen. John had fashioned the rope to the hood, which is also the trunk lid on a Beetle, as a quick, temporary repair when the latch broke. When Sarah's car was found 2 days after she disappeared, the white rope had been removed and was missing.
It was intentionally removed, John McCauley said. I'm wondering if it was used to tie her up.
It's also plausible that Sarah's killer removed the rope with the intent to place her in the trunk of her Volkswagen Beetle, but discovered that the trunk was too small. If the same person who killed Lauren McCarty is responsible for Sarah McCauley's disappearance, it's possible they didn't feel as great a need to hide Lauren's body. Or perhaps the perpetrator was interrupted or spooked and felt taking the time would be a risk. John's emotions and fear that the worst had happened to his wife were, of course, amplified when he heard of Lauren McCarty's murder.
When I heard about it, I got real angry. I just can't believe what people are doing to other people, he said.
With a body and evidence, however scant, police hit Lauren's sexual assault and murder case hard. They lifted prints from her vehicle and told the press not long after she was found that they were sure who killed her, but the evidence wasn't strong enough for an arrest. Law enforcement also looked for a connection between her and Sarah McCauley's disappearance. There were plenty of similarities. Both women were young, in their 20s, and, oddly, both wore purple tops and blue pants. Sarah and Lauren both worked for government employers. Both were last seen in daylight hours, around the same time of day, their disappearances exactly a week apart, less than 15 miles from one another. Property was stolen, including money and both women's purses. Both women's cars were left abandoned in well-populated areas, and neither vehicle had signs that they were the scene of the crime. Lauren McCarty's car was found parked behind a shopping mall, and two witnesses reported that Sarah McCauley's had been parked on a road near a shopping mall. Ultimately, police couldn't confirm or eliminate the possibility that the cases were related. John McCauley couldn't help but obsess about the similarities, though.
The fact that the other woman was found dead scares me. It scares me a lot, he said.
Lauren's case went cold. At the time of Sarah McCauley's disappearance, Austin Police Department Youth Services handled missing persons investigations. Sergeant Don Roper of that unit acknowledged that because Sarah had been missing for so long, it's difficult to not suspect that she met with foul play. The few leads they had, he said, were exhausted early and quickly, and the lack of evidence made the case particularly difficult to work.
Sometimes you find people 3 or 4 years later, but it seems like the farther it goes, the worse it is, because any clues you do have fade away,
Sergeant Roper commented. One clue that looked promising in the investigation of Sarah McCauley's disappearance was the white rope found binding the bludgeoned body of Lauren McCarty. It might have been the same missing white rope from Sarah's car hood, investigators thought. After it was analyzed, however, the rope binding Lauren, presumably compared to the source of the rope missing from Sarah's vehicle, it was determined that they were not the same. After 2 weeks with nothing substantial to go on, with absolutely no promising leads, Sarah's family offered a reward of $1,000 for information leading to her whereabouts. In early January of 1985, Texas Crime Stoppers also began offering a $1,000 reward. In desperation, on December 24, 1984, John McCauley called Dallas psychic John Ketchings to request his aid in the search for his wife. John planned to visit the psychic at his home in Dallas with some of Sarah's jewelry and clothing so he could do what it was he professed to do.
This is my last hope, he told reporters.
Ketchings was familiar to at least some local law enforcement early on in his career. He was asked in 1976 by Dallas police crime analyst Tom Covington to help identify a man responsible for an estimated 75 North Dallas area sexual assaults, a man dubbed the Friendly Rapist. Ketchings gave info on the character of the perpetrator, which is more of a practice of psychology than clairvoyance, but he provided nothing that helped catch the perpetrator. The Friendly Rapist, luckily, was caught the following year in February. Ketchings attracted national attention in 1980 when he led Ennis, Texas detective Ron Rourke to the body of a missing young man there. The case attracted the attention of law enforcement, too. Detective Rourke was the first cop to ever publicly give Ketchings credit, and he became something of a sensation. He was asked on numerous investigations that had police all over the state and country stumped. When Ketchings was 22, he had an out-of-body experience, he claims, after a lightning bolt struck down from a single dark cloud in the sky hit near where he was standing. Ketchings did some soul-searching after that, he says, and heard his calling. He was psychic. It's quite a story, and seems more likely the fact that his mother, Bertie Ketchings, was a long self-proclaimed psychic had more to do with his calling than anything. Regardless, after his hit in Ennis in 1980, it was largely miss after miss for Ketchings thereafter. The same year, he was called to San Angelo to help catch the killer of a young jewelry store clerk who'd been shot and killed in a robbery. The case wouldn't be solved for 21 more years, and not by a psychic. Rather, it was solved not long after Texas began requiring felons to give DNA samples. In 1980, he told police that a missing 15-year-old Waco boy had been either shot or stabbed, his body hidden under natural debris, resulting in a massive search of a specific area that cost the Waco Police Department thousands of dollars. The boy had actually died of suffocation after accidentally locking himself in an abandoned refrigerator in an abandoned shed, presumably to escape the cold. Also in Waco, during the investigation of the unspeakably savage killings of three teenagers known as the Lake Waco murders in 1982, Ketchings took police on several wild goose chases in search of clues and evidence. Before his death in 1992, Ketchings' career as a psychic aide to police waned over the years as the vast majority of his consulting consistently led to nothing in case after case. He was posthumously discredited in 2007 when new evidence led to the conviction of a 1982 murder in Salem, Oregon. Ketchings saw visions, conveniently, of law enforcement's primary person of interest. Investigators had worn the suspect down with intense interrogations, and when they brought in John Ketchings to consult, he confirmed that the police had the right guy. Upon word of this, perhaps hopeless that he'd be able to prove his innocence, the suspect committed suicide. Though the suicide confirmed his guilt to much of the community and to detectives working the case, the man finally tried and convicted, of course, was not that suspect. In January of 1985, when John Ketchings came to Austin to help look for Sarah McCauley, he told her husband that he felt she'd been murdered. Her body, he said, was in a shallow grave just south of Lake Austin, north of Commons Ford Road and Ranch Road 2244, B Cave Road, in West Travis County. It wasn't far from where Sharon's Volkswagen Beetle was found, so it wasn't too much of a stretch. Ketchings had family and police searching through rugged and muddy terrain on the trash-strewn trails. The semi-secluded area had become a popular site for illegal dumping. Investigators, family, and Ketchings looked under old, discarded furniture, plywood, trash, and brush. Ketchings' visions led nowhere, and Sarah's body was never found. Adam Zielinski, Sarah's father, believed that the Austin police didn't take his daughter's disappearance seriously in the beginning, wasting the valuable first 48 hours, the most crucial time to gather evidence and leads. As the police continued to stall, he said, he took it upon himself to seek outside help and hired private investigator R.G. Lopez. In February of 1985, Lopez posted signs along B Cave Road, a well-traveled stretch where witnesses claimed to have seen Sarah's Volkswagen Beetle parked the day she vanished. The signs, placed a few yards apart from one another, asked commuters to stop if they thought they'd seen Sarah's car parked along the road at any time after 2 p.m. on December 10, 1984. Alongside nine of his employees, Lopez lay in wait near the signs for drivers to speak with him. They didn't wait long. Almost 20 individuals stopped within 2 hours, nine of which claimed they were certain they'd seen Sarah's Volkswagen on that day, somewhere near. A few told Lopez that the car was still there the following morning. Some who stopped told the private eye they'd seen Sarah using the phone at a convenience store close by the afternoon she was last seen. The following day, when it was all said and done, a total of 28 people had stopped to offer accounts of seeing either Sarah or her distinctive vehicle. Lopez was told by a few that they saw the missing young woman at a grocery store on Research Boulevard, close to the apartments where her car was found.
This was a case that was on television and in the newspaper for days. I never imagined that so many people would stop, Lopez told a reporter for the Austin Statesman. Continuing, I've asked every person who stopped why they didn't call the police and tell them they had seen the car out there. They all said, we didn't feel it was important enough to call the police, and we didn't want to become an official part of their investigation.
Sarah's father, Adam Zielinski, was frustrated as the trails Lopez was uncovering all ultimately went cold. Adam had tried everything he could think of to find out where his daughter was. He, like John McCauley, tried psychics and, of course, a private investigator, but nothing led him to what happened to Sarah. Adam said it would take a miracle or evoking an emotional response in a witness to uncover the truth, particularly because of short and fading memories. Not long after her disappearance, Sarah's husband, John McCauley, told a reporter that he hadn't come close to giving up hope that his wife was still alive. He hadn't accepted that she was dead, and anyway, Sarah wouldn't want him to think so until he knew for sure, John said. In December of 1985, a year later, John resigned to the fact that Sarah was most likely deceased.
I feel that somebody cheated me. Somebody's cheated me of her,
John solemnly told the press.
I'm trying to find some sort of understanding of it all, but I don't know if it's possible.
The anger and obsessive documentation of days and months had subsided, John said, but as the year anniversary of Sarah's disappearance approached, it was fresh again, as if it had just happened. 15 of Sarah McCauley's friends attended a memorial service in her honor in December of 85 at the spot on Mount Bonnell where she and John were married just 2 years earlier. Poignantly in contrast to Sarah and John's wedding, which was held at sunrise, the memorial was held at sunset. For a moment, in October of 1987, hope that answers might be on the horizon surfaced. The skeletal remains of a female were found alongside the shore in an isolated, rugged, and rarely traveled area near Lake Travis after the water had receded over 30 feet. The remains, minus the skull, were wrapped in a floral comforter, a pair of purple-striped athletic shorts loosely around the waist. A small, diamond-studded horseshoe ring was also found. The jewelry found didn't match anything that Sarah McCauley owned, though, and the remains were ultimately ruled out as being hers. On Wednesday, September 16, 1998, Austin police announced that the Department of Public Safety Crime Lab had made a breakthrough in the 1984 case of the murder of Lauren Marie McCarty. 14 years after Lauren's murder, Richard Allen Woods was arrested and later convicted. Austin detectives, though, still haven't uncovered the truth about what happened to Sarah McCauley, nor have the many psychics, some television crime programs, and a private investigator.
What happens to you is you get flashbacks. You go down the street and you see someone you think looks like her, and all of the sudden there's a flashback and you see her face.
Adam Zelensky said in 1985, continuing,
"You never know when you'll be reminded of her. The flashbacks never end. They just go on and on and on forever."
He knew the reality was that Sarah was likely dead, but until he knew what happened, hope continued to creep in. A secret hope, he called it.
"It will never end until there's a finality to it," Adam Zelensky said.
His obituary echoed his secret hope, listing Sarah as one of his survivors when he passed away in 2010, never knowing what happened to his daughter. If you have any information about the disappearance of Sharon Sarah McCauley, please contact the Austin Police Department's Homicide Tip Line at 512-477-3588 or Capital City Area Crime Stoppers at 512-472-8477. If you're a supporter of Gone Cold on Patreon, be on the lookout for a story about Lauren McCarty and her killer, Richard Allen Woods. It'll be up in the near future. If you're not a supporter but would like to be, you can donate at patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. There are several varying donation levels to choose from, with perks to go along with each, including ad-free listening at all levels. Donations help us cover the costs of research and production, and we can't thank y'all enough for your support. The Austin American Statesman, the Doe Network, and AustinTexas.org were used as sources for this episode. Thanks for listening, y'all.